Hello, and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we have conversations on social justice and how we all get free. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very happy that you're here with me today. My guest today, David Mura, has written numerous books. His most recent book is the acclaimed The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths and Our American Narratives. A third-generation Japanese-American, Mura has written two memoirs, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei, which was listed in the New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and Where the Body Meets Memory, An Odyssey of Race, Sexuality, and Identity. In addition to teaching at various universities, Mura has served as Director of Training for the Innocent Classroom, a program designed by writer and educator Alex Pate to train K through 12 teachers to improve their relationships with students of color. And it is my great pleasure to welcome David to the podcast. Hi, David. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, I'm really pleased that you're here. Your book is beautiful and important, and I just feel like people need to start exploring the concepts that you are discussing. Let's start there. You start your book off by saying that whiteness teaches us how to think about race. And I don't think that most of us realize that this is something that we are actually taught. So can we start with the fact that we're taught to think about race in specific ways that are so under the surface, we don't even notice them most of the time?
In my book, I talk about the origins of the categories of whiteness and blackness, and we don't really think about those origins. But when we think about them, some of the things become very obvious. For instance, in the school of Afro-pessimism, when the categories were originated, whiteness was a symbol of being human, and therefore you could be a citizen of a nation. Blackness was signified non-human, so Black people could not become part of a nation. Therefore, if you were white, violence could not be done upon you unless you had broken the law or war was declared. Whereas violence could be done to the Black body at any time, and it didn't need any sort of legal justification. White people were entitled to the rights to care for and raise their children. Black people were not allowed that right. So we can see how these categories still structure contemporary discussions about race. I mean, obviously, the idea that we're going to restrict through gerrymandering the Black to have a less effect upon who is elected. That's part of that idea that Blackness cannot be a citizen or is secondary citizen. Obviously, in any of the police encounters witnessed over years and years and years, violence can be done to the Black body without any justification is obvious to anybody who has eyes, right? And who's not trying to gaslight us. But I think a deeper manifestation of whiteness is an ideology. It's a set of beliefs, ideas, rules, and practices. And these beliefs, ideas, rules, and practices aren't genetically inherent to white people, but they were developed in order to establish white supremacy and maintain white supremacy. And so one of the beliefs or rules about this is that white knowledge is always valid, objective, true, and official. White knowledge is always valid, objective, true, and official, and Black knowledge is always invalid, subjective, false or suspicious, and unofficial, unless whiteness decrees it's official. Now, when we think about that, that rule is everywhere. It's there, obviously, in accounts of what happens between Black citizens and the police.
Yes.
But it's also there when a Black patient is in a waiting room telling somebody, a medical technician or the doctor, about their level of pain. It's there in school when somebody is saying this happened and who you can believe, the white student or the Black student. This is always going on, and we see manifestations of this, and it has become so natural that there's part of us that may object to it, but part of us don't realize how deeply this rule is ingrained. For instance, you take Governor DeSantis. There's all this stuff about anti-woke, which is just nonsense and gaslighting. And there was a woman a few weeks ago who had written an anti-woke book, and when she was asked to define wokeness, she couldn't define it. And that video went viral. Now, the DeSantis is a little smarter. They define wokeness as the belief that there is systemic injustice in the United States. So according to the DeSantis administration, you can't even discuss the question about whether there is systemic injustice and therefore systemic racial injustice in the United States. And who establishes that rule? It is white people who establish that rule. It's not people of color who would establish that rule. And when he takes the African-American AP studies course and declares that it lacks educational value, what he is saying is, he's not an African-American scholar, he's not an African-American writer, but he's saying, I as a white person can evaluate this, even though I don't have a PhD in African-American studies, even though I don't have an MFA as an African-American creative writer, I can still deem this uneducational.
Yes.
And then the other thing is what he's saying is these Black scholars and writers are not qualified to construct an AP history course and cultural studies course. Now, if you go back to slavery, what did the slavers do when the Africans came? They said, you can't teach your language. You can't teach your history. You can't teach your culture. So DeSantis is in the tradition of the slave owner forbidding Black people from educating themselves about themselves. But we don't see that link.
I think that that is a really important point, and it's a point you make consistently through the book, is that one of the hardest parts of reckoning with and moving out of a white supremacy mindset is that in order to do this, it's going to require white Americans to construct a new story about themselves, both past and present. And when you reference DeSantis and his trying to ban African-American history courses, the thing that struck me there was how much fear there must be underlying that decision. Not only hubris and we're superior, but fear of having the actual truth of our history of this country taught. And I wonder how you think we start to engage with that aspect of this really thorny problem.
Well, this problem takes place on many different levels in trying to address it. Let me just start with the sort of obvious thing. For instance, now you have groups like Moms for Liberty wanting to ban books like The Story of Ruby Bridges.
Yes.
So Ruby Bridges was a six-year-old Black girl who desegregated a New Orleans school in 1960. And she had to pass through a crowd of jeering, insulting, spitting white people with signs to get to the school. Now, Moms for Liberty says, well, this is going to make our children feel bad. This is going to make them feel bad about being white. And this is going to teach that they're racist. My children are half Japanese American, half white American, European American, and they read the book and they were inspired by Ruby Bridges. They were inspired by her courage, her fight for social justice. So what these Moms for Liberty are either saying is, our children can't possibly identify with Ruby Bridges and her struggle. They can't, or they are afraid that their children will identify with Ruby Bridges, identify with her struggle. Because below a certain age, kids don't have racism. They have to be taught racism, right?
Yes.
And if you get them young enough and you teach them these stories, they understand there's another way of looking at the world, which is not racist, even though the adults around me are teaching me to be a racist, right?
Yes.
But the other thing is that if you think about it, the Moms for Liberty, oh, our white children are so fragile. Well, if they were concerned about the fragility of children, they would be concerned that every single African-American parent must tell their child of police brutality, police murders, in order to protect their children when they encounter the police. But of course, they're not concerned with the fragility of Black children, or the fact that Black children have to be exposed to these narratives in order to survive in this society. Now, how do you change these people? It's a very difficult thing. What I will say is I always begin my talks by saying, I don't believe you change people through guilt and shame. Now, sometimes in discussions of race, more generally, guilt and shame do come up, but I don't think they're useful. And I think we change people through love and knowledge and asking people to be humble, because no one knows enough about race. No matter if you're a person of color, I don't necessarily know enough about Native and Indigenous Americans that I wouldn't somehow make a mistake or say something stupid. And then you do that, and then you have to just be humble and say, okay, I made a mistake, or a pocket of my ignorance was exposed, and I need to work to remedy that.
Yes.
And so it's a spiritual task. And what is so hard, I think, at this moment is that you have this rise of white Christian nationalism, and it would be easier if the emphasis was on Christian, but it's not. It's on, and the emphasis is on white nationalism. And so the Good Samaritan is the white man who choked Jordan Neely on a New York subway, which is entirely the opposite of the parable of the Good Samaritan, who helps a man who's been beaten and left by the side of the road, not kills him, and brings the man to his house and feeds him. So we've so twisted even the meaning of Christianity that it's bent itself, contorted itself, all sorts of ways to accommodate whiteness. Like Russell Moore, who edits an evangelical newsletter, has said that he's had pastors come up to him and tell him when they preach the Sermon on the Mount, you know, blessed are the poor, for they shall inherit, blessed are the meek, right? Members of his congregation come up to him and say, where did you get those liberal talking points?
No, are you kidding me?
Part of it, I think, you know, we have to go back to these values that America purports to believe, right? And, you know, I'm not a practicing Christian, but, you know, remind people as Christians what the values are, what the parable of the Good Samaritan actually says.
I'm so stunned by that. That there is literally pushback against one of the central tenets of Christianity, which is to be kind to those in need, to extend oneself to those in need. We've, as a society, have gotten a long way off track. I will say, I do actually think there is one use for shame. I agree with you that I don't think shame or guilt are good tools for changing people. I think shame is a good internal tool. When we experience shame for something we did, it can move us to be better. We can say, you know, I'm ashamed of myself for that. That comment really doesn't reflect who I aspire to be. I'm going to do better. But beyond that, I think that we've gotten so focused on external conversation rather than sort of an internal inquiry into these things that it's very easy for us to get into our silos and just be stuck and feel like, well, I consider myself liberal, I consider myself woke, so I don't have work to do. Or on the other end of the spectrum, woke is terrible and it's trying to destroy our country, so I'm just going to pay no attention to it. And instead of meeting, I'm not going to say in the middle, because I don't really think that that's the place we should be meeting, but it's on the way there, and finding the places where we can have conversations about these really challenging subjects without it devolving into a screaming match or just people not being willing to engage at all, because that feels like where we are, and that place feels very scary to me.
I completely agree with you with what the example that you said about your thinking, like, you know, I feel ashamed of what I done. But what I am talking about is the way that shame can work, where people think, you're saying I'm a bad person.
Yeah, that's not helpful.
And the choices between I'm a bad person or I'm not going to listen to you, almost everybody will choose I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I want to remove it from the personal. I'm going to leave it up to you to think about your own individual conscience. Because I don't know you. I don't know who you are. But what I do know is there is systemic racism in America. There are systemic injustices. And the explanations that there are only a few bad apples is entirely nonsense and gaslighting. I mean, you don't get the health disparities. You don't get the economic disparities, the educational disparities, the disparities in our justice system without something that's systemic.
Look, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think another word for systemic really could be intentional here, right? It's not just that it's in the system. It is intentionally in our system. These injustices, they are built into the system, and it was done with intention. It was done sneakily, but it was done intentionally.
Yes, no, absolutely. And the historian of the Reconstruction, David Blight, has said, hypocrisy is the tool of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk about these rules, for instance, of ideas and beliefs which compose whiteness, another one is our definition of racism. So the definition of racism is always you have to discriminate or insult or take a violent action towards a person of a different race. But it's not only that. You have to avow that you are doing this for racist reasons. And so you can act in a racist or a biased manner, but as long as you come up with another reason for your actions,
yes,
right, it can never be called racism. Now, this is a definition I think that most people of color would not assent to, because it makes racism impossible to prove, right? Because even the KKK will not say, like David Duke will say, I'm not a racist, you know?
Yes.
And so whatever people do, you know, they can restrict people's voting rights. A policeman can kill an unarmed Black person and still say, well, the reason why I did it was not racism. Now, what we know is there is explicit and conscious racial bias, where people actively believe racist. But most of the time, people will not say that that's what they believe in public. They may say it in private to their friends who agree with them. They won't. So that's explicit or conscious racial bias. But we also know there is an implicit or unconscious racial bias, where someone may actively think, you know, I want to treat everybody equal, but in practice they don't. You know, there's a famous test, Harvard's test, where you can test yourself for this. And there's things like you're shown pictures of a child with an object in their hand. And people with implicit racial bias will see that object as a gun in a Black child's hand more likely than a white child's hand. Or it's not that people won't be able to associate positive attributes to a Black face as a white face, but it takes just a fraction longer for them to do so. And I first read this about this in Malcolm Gladwell, and he said, I showed implicit bias and my mother is Black. And we've seen this, you know, with Black cops and Black teachers. So there's this whole implicit bias, and how does implicit bias happen? We don't really understand how it's created by stereotypes, by unconscious rules, like white knowledge is always superior to Black knowledge. And the thing that always gets me about this, about white knowledge, is that every single point in our history, the majority of white people were wrong about racial issues, and the majority of Black people were right. And yet, white America has never turned to Black America and said, we got it wrong every single time in our history, whether it was slavery, whether it's Reconstruction, Jim Crow, the civil rights laws. Maybe we should listen to you.
I think that across the board, the minority knows more about the majority than vice versa, because it's a matter of survival.
Yeah.
Women know more about men. Black people know more about white people, and you can just go down the list. We have to. We wouldn't be able to get through our daily lives if we weren't able to navigate all of the particular rules that are set up in those structures. And I think it's a really important thing for people to recognize is how much more the minority understands about the majority than vice versa. Because then you can start to inquire about why that is the case and start to inquire about what the majority might want to do to remedy this fact. And until then, we just keep going down the path we're going. And the problem is there's very little incentive for the majority to change their behavior. And now, as the dynamics are starting to shift, as the population demographic is shifting, and white people are starting to feel a particular pressure because they're not going to be in the majority in, what, 20 years from now, less than 20 years from now, this tension that we're seeing and the actions of people like Ron DeSantis are becoming more overt and more frequent as they try to hang on to these vestiges of power with all they've got.
Yes. One of the theses is that every moment in American history where there has been ostensible legal progress towards racial equality, there has been a concerted effort by the white population, by portions of the white population, to create a backlash, to regress society back to before these legal remedies to discrimination and hate were enacted. So you see this in Reconstruction and the construction of Jim Crow. You see this after the passage of the civil rights laws, where people created private school systems and religious schools. And today, many of the cities in the South are just as racially segregated or more so than they were in 1956. And so right now, what you have in certain ways is the echoes of Reconstruction. Because what the white population realized in the South after the Civil War is that if Black people can vote and they're allowed to vote, they're going to elect representatives for themselves who represent the views of equality, the views of freedom and democracy. And that is antithetical because the belief somehow that the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment were passed, suddenly all the people in the South went, oh, yeah, Black people are equal. Let's make them citizens. I don't believe in slavery anymore. That's just nonsense. It didn't change the hearts and minds of white Southerners, and they were suddenly terrified, right? Because Black people could vote. And so it's like, how do we take away the citizenship? They made a very concentrated effort, which took place not only on the legal front, right? So you had the enactment of, say, Black codes, right? Where the laws were Black people, they were not literally actually working for a white person. They could be arrested, and not just by police, by anyone. Well, that explains the existence of Karens today.
Yes, it does.
White Karens, right? Who feel authorized to call the police on Black people. But it also took place on things like states' rights. And what they did is they tried to shrink the public sphere legally and expand the private sphere. So anything that happened in the private sphere, if it was hatred, if it was discrimination, wasn't covered by the legal remedies enacted by the amendments. And of course, after the Black Codes, as Douglas Blackman has shown in his book, A Slavery by Another Name, you know, you had 100,000 Black people who were under slave labor, right?
Yes.
So the South reinstituted. So the white people freaking out now, like, we believe in democracy as long as we're the majority. If we're not in the majority, we don't believe in democracy anymore, right? That's what happened in the South after Reconstruction. And so when people say the past is all the way in the past, no, it's not. It's echoed constantly in the present.
And I think that one of the things that's important to understand about that is that those echoes aren't just amongst people who are racist, whether they know it or not. It's also amongst people who seem to be on the surface of it quite liberal and very profoundly in support of equality and justice. And when I was reading your book, you use an example in there of the movie Amistad, Steven Spielberg's film. And you talk about how that movie starts. And then you bring in an interpretation of that opening scene as written by a Black man rather than the white writers who wrote the film Amistad. And that struck me so powerfully because it's literally about how we tell stories and the profound implications of the differing points of view on how stories are seen and received by audiences. Can you speak briefly about that whole thing?
So I am really good friends with Alex Pate, who's a novelist and an educator, and he's created this wonderful educational program, which I want to mention. People should look it up. It's called The Innocent Classroom, which is designed to train K through 12 teachers to improve their relationships with students of color. And I've worked as director of training in that program, and it's a terrific program. But Alex is a novelist, and so he was hired by DreamWorks to create the novelization of the film script Amistad. Now, in the film, you see in the opening scenes, the Africans, and they're in chains, but as they're speaking, there's no subtitles. So you can't understand what they're saying, right?
Because they're speaking in their own languages.
Yeah. Spielberg easily could have had subtitles under. So they're indecipherable, right? And then their first act is an act of violence, and they kill the Spanish sailors and take over the ship. So you don't know if these are prisoners. They could have committed a crime. And their first act of violence is an act of violence against white people. So you don't see the violence that made them slaves, right? You don't see the violence that put them in chains in the ship. All you see is the violence that they enact. Now, my friend Alex had to create the novelization of the film script, and he had to use everything from the film. But he looked at that opening set and says, I can't start my novel here. And of course, if you remember the film is the Africans, instead of sailing them back to Africa, they sail them to the United States, where they have to have a trial to decide whether they are free men or slaves. And the young white lawyer, played by Matthew McConaughey, tries to enlist the John Quincy Adams, the 7th president, to help him with arguing the case. So the movie is seen mostly through the viewpoint of the young Matthew McConaughey character and John Quincy Adams. So Alex looked at that and go, no, I can't do that either. So he starts the novel in Africa, and Sinke is sleeping next to his wife and child. So he has a family, he has a village, he has a culture, and he's not indecipherable because, contrary to the movie, Alex decides to tell the story through the consciousness of Sinke, his thoughts and feelings. He's not indecipherable. And he walks out, and he's sort of uneasy. And a little later, a lion comes and attacks the village, and he kills the lion. So his first act of violence is an act saving his family. So obviously a different set of actions. He's understandable. It's told from his point of view. But even more than that, remember in The Souls of Black Folks, the boy said, what does it mean to be a problem? Well, in Africa, Sinke's Blackness is not a problem. It's not a question. Yes. It's not a question of whiteness versus blackness. There is no whiteness. Yes. And he doesn't have to go to white people to say, am I free or am I a slave? So he starts it outside the ontology, the categories of whiteness and blackness. And so it's in a completely different, not only legal realm, but racial category realm. And I don't believe Spielberg is a conscious race. He's adopted two Black kids. He's a Jewish liberal director. I think he meant well with his film, but he couldn't think himself out of whiteness.
Right.
You know, Alex created an African-American novel out of a white film script.
Yes. And as you say in your book, Blackness doesn't exist. It has no inherent meaning outside of the context of whiteness. Yes. If you take whiteness away, then blackness doesn't mean anything. Yes. And it's really important, I think, for people to understand that, because, you know, when I read a book and the author describes a character and mentions their race, they're never white, ever. They are either Black or Asian or Indigenous or something not white, because whiteness is the default.
Yes. So if I read a passage which says, Bill and Bridget were arguing in their kitchen. They lived on the Upper West Side of New York. Their apartment looked down on the river. And it goes on. We're to assume that Bill and Bridget are white, right? But if I'm writing, Tom and Terry were arguing in the kitchen in Las Vegas. You could see out the patio window the fifth green of the 11th hole in their subdivision, right? I somehow have to tell the reader that not only are my parents Japanese American, right, but they're second generation Japanese American, that as children, they were imprisoned by the United States government and taken from their homes and kept behind barbed wire fences under rifle towers guards. Because you're not going to understand who my parents are unless you understand that. So the white author is going, whiteness is the universal default. Everything else is the exception. But not only that, Bill and Bridget being white is not important to the way they think about themselves. It's not important to their life experiences. To which any reader of color would go, nonsense. You know, I'm a Japanese American. I read Bill and Bridget. They're white. They're a white couple. I don't see them as universal, you know, and I don't think that their being white is unimportant to the way they conceive about themselves or their life experiences. Just as my being Japanese American and the third generation Japanese American shapes how I think about myself, how people interact with me, what my life experiences have been.
Yes.
And so the idea that Bill and Bridget are raceless somehow is implied in the technique of never having to identify your characters and understanding that if you don't identify your characters racially, everybody will assume they're white. It's a position actually much close to a conservative racial position, even though almost all American literary authors, white American literary authors, consider themselves progressive liberals.
Yes. I think that this is a really important point, and I wish we had more time, but I want to talk with you about the work that you are actually doing that you just mentioned with The Innocent Classroom. And I actually think that this is sort of a good segue into it, because if we can teach children to see things differently and to see the breadth of different people's experiences, that's really important. And if we can have educators who represent different experiences and can talk to the scope of experiences, that's really important. So would you talk a bit about The Innocent Classroom and what that is?
We asked the teachers, what does American society tell you about children of color? And sometimes we have to prod them, to be honest. But then we get things like angry, gang members, unwed mothers, dropouts, violent, sassy, illegal, terrorists, ugly. And we keep going until we get a list of 40 to 50 things. And it's just horrifying. So that even things that might seem good, like athletic in this list, don't really seem so good. And we say, if you know this list, the children know this list. And some of you are looking through the children through the lens of this list. But we say, these are children. All of these stereotypes are like guilts, which unearned guilts that can infect their minds and the way that they think about themselves. Because some children begin to look at it and they go, this is how American society sees me. I don't have any other choices. Yes. Some kids almost look at that list as fate. I don't have any choice. And we say, these are children. They should be regarded as innocent. You have to create this classroom where none of these stereotypes affect them, where they are seen as individuals first. And we say, in order to do this, just a simple tool, we say you have to find their good. And their good we define not as good, bad, but the way Aristotle defined it, as that for which all things are done. So we give the teachers a list of things like smart, respected, leader, belonging, normal, safe, stable. And we say, find the thing that that child really craves, needs, is motivated by. And if you begin reinforcing that, the child will, because many children think you look at them through this list, they're not going to trust you, because you have to earn that trust. And teachers don't really think that they have to do that, but that's the effect of racism in the society. But to do this, you have to know the child individually. So if the child has moved 8 times in 2 years, their good might be stability. But in order to understand that, you have to know enough about the child. Or if the child has her head on the desk Monday morning, and you don't know that their mother works 2 jobs, and so they're the ones who cooked for their siblings dinner, put them to bed, did the cleaning, and of course they're tired on Monday morning. And it's not that they're not interested in school. It's very interesting, because we don't recommend that teachers do this. But one fifth grade teacher in the school I was working with, and the school was about 95% Black, asked the students, his fifth grade class, what does American society think of children of color? And he got the same list as the teachers. And then, these are fifth graders.
Yes.
They discussed the list for 45 minutes, unguided by the teacher. And then one of the kids said, well, what's the antidote to this list? And another kid said, isn't it education? And another kid said, yeah, but if we're screwing around, aren't we screwing around with the antidote?
Cool.
So these kids, they understand my book, The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, begins with the police murder of Philando Castile, which took place 4 years before George Floyd was murdered. And that murder took place maybe 3 miles from my house. And George Floyd was murdered 4 miles from my house. So all of this was very close to me. And after George Floyd was murdered, I have an essay on it at the end of my book. And a teacher from the North Side, which is mainly Black in Minneapolis, a white teacher said she had asked her seventh grade class to write an essay on my America. And she said 100% of them wrote about police harassment.
Wow.
These are seventh graders. They're bright, they're curious, they're energetic, they're intelligent. And this is their America. And so when people say, well, don't teach critical race theory, I mean, America is teaching these kids critical race theory because they have to live with the effects of racism. And when you gaslight them and tell them that racism doesn't exist, it doesn't help Black students and it doesn't help white students.
No, it helps no one. I wish we had more time, but we don't. So I'm going to ask if you would give the listeners 3 simple things that they can do to start to move themselves in the direction of engaging with the concepts we've been talking about more directly.
So none of us knows enough. We all have pockets of ignorance and we have to keep learning. So it is simply just books, lectures, activities, arts activities to learn about people both within your community and outside your community. And secondly, if your social life or your work life is racially or ethnically homogenous, you need to start diversifying and making conscious moves to diversify. And if you're a white person, you have no Black friends or friends of color, then you have to ask, why is that? How can I change my life so that's so? And of course, you think of things like the most segregated hour in America is church hour on Sunday morning. Maybe go to a different church. Then once you understand the way racism works, you have to begin to work against it and actively work. And oftentimes you'll know you're working against it when people get angry at you. And so part of this entails a change in identity. And Helen Kubler-Ross in On Death and Dying said the 5 stages of grief are denial, anger, bargaining, grief, and acceptance. So with racism, there's no racism. It's Juan DeSantis. There is no systemic injustice in America. Then it's anger. Why are you bringing this up? We had a perfectly fine school, state, institution, business, until you started bringing up these charges of racism. It's your fault that we're having these problems. Then it's bargaining. Okay, there may be racism, but it's just a few bad apples. As Chris Rock said, would you want to fly in an airline that had a few bad apples for pilots? Would you want to be operated in a surgery department that had a few bad apples for surgeons? Of course not. It is systemic. And so you have to accept. And then it's grief. Then sometimes it's sadness for what people of color have gone through. Sometimes it's sadness and shame about being white. But I don't think you should spend a lot of time going, am I a bad person or not? That's not the question. The question is, do you accept the existence of a systemic racism in America? And once you accept that existence, you stop resisting, spending all this energy resisting. But in order to do that, you have to change how you think about yourself. And Baldwin said, the question of identity is a question inducing the most profound panic. A panic is a terror, is primary, is the nightmare of the mortal fall. So in other words, to change your identity is as scary to people as contemplating, I'm going to die, I'm mortal. But he says, and there's a long, eloquent passage, which I won't quote here, but it's essentially, we have to be humble. And it's only the humility that allows us to go, maybe we were wrong. Maybe the way we thought about ourselves is incorrect. Maybe we didn't know everything. And maybe our identity, the way we've thought about, isn't who we are. I can doff that. And you actually see this in, say, white supremacists or white nationalists who've undergone a transformation, right? They understand, like, this identity, it was not only wrong, it harmed me. It made my soul sick. And I didn't want that sickness anymore. I didn't want that hate anymore. And they're relieved. But you have to go through this terror. How will I know who I am if I abandon the way I've been thinking, if I abandon my identity? And so it really is a spiritual leap. And this is why I want to talk about it less at this level, on a political level, but on a personal spiritual level.
I think that's really important because ultimately political change comes out of a change in our own belief systems, our change in our acceptance of what we find to be the way things should be. You know, when we say, you know what, I've changed my mind, this is no longer acceptable to me, and I'm going to petition to have laws instituted that uphold true equality, not these things that sort of slide over and make you think, oh, that's better, but the underlying reality is very different. So I appreciate your saying that, because I do believe that the first place we start is close in, and we start with healing our own understanding and then moving forward from there. Well, this has been really wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and just the generosity of spirit in your book, because these are hard things to come to terms with, but you create an environment that makes it possible for us to enter into this and feel like, yes, okay, mistakes have been made, mistakes are still being made, we all have work to do, and it's possible. And I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me. And thank you for doing this program, which I know is spreading the word and light to people. So,
oh, thank you so much for saying that. That means a lot to me. Again, thank you, David. And we will, I hope, cross paths at some point again in the future.
Okay, great.
Story is how we humans make sense of the world. The stories we tell ourselves determine the actions we take, how we move through the world, and how we engage with others. Examining those stories requires that we pay attention in ways we often don't think about, that we ask ourselves hard questions and don't rush towards easy answers. David's beautiful book gives us a way into meaningful exploration of the stories that we tell and ways to begin to write stories that create the space to become the people and the country we say we want to be. Thank you so much for listening. As I say every time, change begins with story, so keep sharing yours. I'll be back with another episode of Stepping Into Truth very soon.